This is Imperfectly Honest. I'm Elizabeth, and after about four decades, I'm shifting from the person I always thought I should be to the person I really want to be, in part because I've learned to be honest, both with myself and just about everybody I encounter. It's not always perfect. Sometimes it's a rocky road, but I'm learning a lot by being imperfectly honest and thought you might learn something too. Hey, y'all. Today's podcast is for anyone who buys things, which is pretty much everyone. My friend and collaborator, Seth Levine, recently released a book with his co-author, Elizabeth McBride, called Capital Evolution, about the evolution of capitalism. And when Seth reached out to me to ask to come on the podcast to talk about the book, my first reaction was yes. I typically like to listen to anything that Seth has to say, but I did kind of wonder whether our conversation would be relevant to the breadth of our listenership. But after having this conversation, I feel that it is relevant to pretty much anyone, and I hope that you feel that way too. And I hope you pick up a copy of the book, Capital Evolution, Seth Levine and Elizabeth McBride. We're going to tell you that a couple times throughout this podcast. And you can pick up that book on Amazon, or even better, at your local independent bookstore. And Seth's wife, Greeley Sachs, recently opened up a new independent bookstore. Yes, they do still exist. Called Composition Shop in Longmont, Colorado, for those of you in that neck of the woods. All right, here's the show.
Hey, y'all.
We have a special guest today, Seth Levine. Seth has been a longtime supporter of the work that I've been doing for the last decade or so, and has become a dear friend. And he just wrote a book. And it's on a topic that I find interesting, and I think some of you might find interesting. And so here we are. Seth, thanks for joining us today.
It's good to be here, Elizabeth. It's been a little bit since we've had a chance to connect, so it's just really nice to see you and spend some time with you.
Seth, do you want to just start, instead of me introducing you, you want to just start with a quick intro and a quick overview of what you're working on?
Sure. Yeah, I'm happy to. I will do the very fast version because I've been a venture capitalist for 25 years. So it's sort of like talking about anything other than that. It's sort of like, you know, I was young and is sort of not relevant, but I've been in the venture business for 25 years. I started working initially for a Palo Alto based very large venture firm that was initially affiliated with SoftBank and then eventually was sort of independent. And then in 2006, me and three other people came together and we founded a venture firm in Boulder called Foundry. We've raised about $4 billion. We invest, initially we were only investing in startups and in tech businesses. And eventually we decided to start investing in other venture funds as well. It's sort of an offshoot of some personal investing we had done, including in MergeLane, which is part of how Elizabeth and I spent some time together. And so we now have a portfolio of about 50 underlying venture funds, and then our own venture fund, which sort of comprises the Foundry platform. And I should note that we made the decision, we raised our last fund in 2022, and then in 2023, we sort of announced to the world that we were not going to raise any more funds, but instead we were going to kind of manage out the funds that we had. And for a whole bunch of reasons, that was kind of part of the founding principle of Foundry. But we'd sort of maybe gone away from that and then eventually decided to get back to it. But other than that, I live just outside of Boulder. My wife and I have three kids who are now sort of college aged. She's a real estate developer in Longmont, our hometown. She redoes these historic buildings along the downtown corridor and also owns the local bookstore. So we got a lot going on. We have a little mini farm too. So I pretend to be a farmer. I'm looking out at my pasture right now. We've got a couple horses and some miniature donkeys and some goats and a lot of apple trees. So it's a eclectic mix.
I love it. Definitely eclectic mix on many levels. I love it. So Seth, you've had some success. You could spend your time doing pretty much anything. Why this book?
Yeah. So we wrote our first book. I'm using the we pronoun there because both these books were written with a friend of mine, a journalist, Elizabeth McBride. We wrote our first book in 2021, and you know, I didn't really want it to be just sort of a typical VC book where I just sort of sat at my computer and pontificated about things that I had, you know, whatever, come to learn over the last 25 years of being in venture. Really wanted to write books that were sort of deep thought pieces, well-researched, et cetera. And the first book was really on the changing nature of entrepreneurship in the United States, specifically women and people of color starting more businesses than really anyone else. That book's called The New Builders. And that really kind of resonated in the world. You know, Elizabeth and I, Elizabeth McBride, my co-author and I, were just tossing around some other ideas and thinking about sort of what might be next. And you know, these questions resonate with me. And I sometimes joke, like, my mind is a very busy place. I struggle to, like, sort of calm it down or quiet it down. And something happens when I get really into a writing project and when I'm writing. And that is that I finally kind of get a little bit of that peace in my head. And so I think because of that, really enjoy writing. I also really enjoy getting ideas sort of out into the public sphere. And as we were sort of talking about the sort of current state of the world, this was maybe three and a half years ago, you know, one of the topics, and this I was getting this from companies in our portfolio as well, one of the topics was, you know, what's the right role for businesses in our society? And specifically, how much should they be speaking up about sort of political matters effectively and social matters? And that got us thinking a little bit about sort of, well, what's the structure of the capitalist society that we live in? And does that really make sense? And it got us thinking a little bit about, well, what's the future of capitalism? And frankly, the role of businesses in our economy, in our political economy. And so we really lucked out because, you know, now the timing for that conversation is really, really good. I mean, we spent 3 years researching and then writing the book. And of course, we're just on the heels of an election that saw, you know, a socialist take power in the mayorship of New York, which is the, you know, arguably the financial capital of the world. And, you know, this question around socialism versus capitalism is an interesting one. And so the book is perfectly timed. I mean, the book in large part it's both a defense of capitalism. And I like to joke that I'm a capitalist by job title as a venture capitalist, but also just by predilection. But it talks about some of the challenges of neoliberal capitalism, which is the style of capitalism we've been living under for essentially all of everyone who's listening to this lifetime, outlined initially by Milton Friedman, first in his book in the late 60s, and then eventually in a thought piece that he wrote for the New York Times in 1970. And that really described that the only job of a company and its board of directors was to maximize value for shareholders. And that was kind of taken for granted over a period of time, particularly Reagan and Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher kind of pushed this idea in the 80s. If you think about sort of the globalization trends and sort of what happened throughout the 90s, it really was following the neoliberal playbook. And Elizabeth and I wanted to take a step back and sort of question whether that really makes sense. And we're not the only ones to do that, by the way. In 2019, the Business Roundtable, which is comprised of the 200 or so CEOs of the largest companies in the United States, they came out with a statement about the purpose of a corporation that clarified that actually there are other stakeholders that matter to a business and should matter to a business, especially if you're thinking in the long term. Those include employees, suppliers, the climate, et cetera. And so it seemed like a good time to be talking about it. And again, we got really lucky because, you know, right now, right as the book is coming out, you know, this is a very, very sort of popular topic of conversation at the moment. So that's kind of what the book is about. I'm sure we'll dig into it a little bit more, but that's kind of what drove it. And I, you know, I really, it's funny. I mean, I have a day job, right? I mean, I'm pretty busy with with my work at Foundry, but it was really important to me to carve out the time that it required to write this book. And it was a lot of time. It was a lot of work. We interviewed probably, I don't know, 100 different thought leaders, CEOs, people from like Jamie Dimon from JP Morgan, Dan Schulman, who's now the CEO of Verizon, Lisa Green Hall, who was a pioneer in impact investing at Apollo. And then also, you know, people sort of up and down the corporate chain to get their perspectives on this topic. And so it was a lot of work, but it was a labor of love. And you know, I really, as I mentioned, it was something that kind of quieted my mind and got me really focused, which I loved.
Mm. Yeah, that idea of writing, quieting your mind definitely resonates with me. I have that experience as well. And I'm glad that you've found something that a lot of people can benefit from to quiet your mind. So that just works great.
Some people meditate. I write books. It works.
I love it. We have a variety of different kinds of listeners that range from people who are very knowledgeable about business and capitalism to people who are artists and have never been in the business world at all. So, what's the one thing or a thing that you would want sort of every layperson to know on this topic? Which, by the way, I'm not sure that we even mentioned the title of the book yet. I'll do that in the intro. But in case people tune out the intro, the name of the book is Capital Evolution. And Seth, what's your sort of 30-second elevator pitch on the book?
Yeah, and the elevator pitch is that the capitalism needs to change and evolve. It remains the best system for organizing our economy, but it can't remain static. And the kind of capitalism we've been practicing over the last 50 years has led to too much economic inequality and instability. We see that in our politics, and we see that across our economy. And in order for really everyone to prosper, and I include people who are at the very top end of the economic bracket in that statement, really we need to do a better job of lifting more people up. Our economy has lost a lot of its dynamism. We've lost sort of the opportunity economy, the American dream, that once was so strong here. We can absolutely get it back again, but it's going to take a little bit of work. That's the quick pitch. And thank you for mentioning the book title. Yeah, the Capital Evolution is the name of the book. We should probably mention that a few times while we're talking, but I appreciate it. And by the way, you can pick it up at your local bookstore or on Amazon, Barnes and Noble, Books a Million, or you can go to thecapitalevolution.com and you can read a little bit more about it because we've got some information there.
Great, great. So, what's the one thing that every layperson should know on this topic of the evolution of capitalism?
Well, let me start with something that was sort of, I guess, a little bit of a surprise for me. I mean, I hadn't thought deeply about what defines capitalism, right? I mean, what is that? And I'd always thought about it as an economic construct, because, of course, it defines the economy. But as Elizabeth and I really thought about it and wrote about it, we came back to this notion that actually capitalism is more like a compact, right? It's an agreement between and among people, between people and the government that defines how that system is organized. And I think that that's maybe a little bit counterintuitive to some folks to think about it that way. We talk about this at length in the book because for us it was a bit of a revelation that, yeah, there's some economic constructs that underlie capitalism, specifically free markets and the private ownership of assets. But actually, once you get beyond that, there's not a lot of agreement. And so it really, the type of capitalism that you practice is really dependent on where you are and sort of what that agreement is, what that compact is between you and your government, between you and other people. And I think that's really important for people to think about. And I would say to the artists and the other people that are listening in, obviously we're all participating in this capitalist society, right? This is how the US works, and obviously kind of, every time you trade or sell a painting or trade some work for something else so that you can go buy food, shelter, all the things, right? We are participating in that economy. And I think that really everyone, because of that, has a stake in what the rules are and how we organize that economy. And so that's why this topic, for me at least, I think is so interesting, right? I mean, the book itself is not, certainly not written from a highly academic perspective, right? I mean, it's not that we don't cite studies, and it's not, obviously not that it's not well researched. It's very well researched. But one of our complaints of other books that we came across as we started to research this is that most of the books on the future of capitalism have either been written by academics, which makes them a little dry, or a lot dry in some cases, and not always particularly interesting, or they were sort of one person's story, right? A CEO of a company, and they did things a certain way, and they treated their employees this way or that, and they write it up in a book. But I felt like, or we felt like, no one had really approached it in the way that we were trying to approach it, which is from the perspective of practitioners of capitalism, right? I mean, you know, we are Elizabeth, my writing partner, is a business journalist. She's been covering sort of the business economy for 30 years, and I've been in business broadly and in venture capital specifically for also similarly 30 years. And we felt like that was a really unique perspective to bring. The book is, I think, interesting, accessible, dare I say, well written, but you know, thought provoking, right? And I think we're trying to ask some hard questions about the role of businesses in our society, about the role of government in our society, about how we want to organize. And we, you know, we want it to be a bit thought provoking, or maybe a lot thought provoking. And you know, we wanted to get some of these ideas out into the world, which is always a little bit scary because, you know, I think the idea is that people should disagree with at least some of what we write. But we felt like it was important to participate in the conversation and maybe spur some thinking. So I, you know, hopefully, I mean, obviously my goal for this discussion is that for people listening, kind of piques their interest and they say, I want to learn more. And then they go pick up the book and hopefully reach out to us and say, hey, this resonated, this I didn't really understand. You know, that was my goal in writing the book.
Great. And you know, the title of this podcast isn't perfectly honest. And one of the things that we want to do with this podcast is to provoke thought. And sometimes the best way to do that is to provide some contrarian questions or contrarian thoughts. And what's one thought that you want to share with the audience that's a bit contrarian and ideally maybe a little hard for you to say publicly?
Well, I mean, we said it all in the book, so I guess we are saying it publicly. I think I was surprised. I thought I would go. I mean, I went into this project and I thought I would come out of it thinking that, you know, businesses need to speak up, right? Like there are so many important things going on in the world right now, and it's just critical for businesses and business leaders to be out there on the front lines. And I came away actually thinking that's a terrible idea. It's in a world that we where we've just everything has become totally politicized. It just doesn't. It actually, I don't think, makes sense to expect companies and CEOs to speak out on politics, right? And then I would differentiate politics and values a little bit. I think it's completely appropriate. Jamie Dimon kind of walked us through this as well and was instrumental in some of our thinking around this. But you know, I would draw a line between values and politics. And I think people, I hear pushback from that from people, especially sort of my more liberal leaning friends who are like, no, it's the responsibility of businesses to call out injustice in our society and things like that. And I, again, I came into this thinking, yeah, that's exactly right. But I came out of it thinking that is very messy, and we run the risk and the likelihood, frankly, that, you know, all companies then get sort of placed somewhere on the political spectrum. And I don't think that's what we want in our society, and I don't think that's what we ultimately actually want from businesses. I was surprised by that, and I suspect people listening might disagree with that, but to your question and being a bit, you know, sort of open and vulnerable about it, absolutely. I think that was a surprising outcome. And obviously in the book, we talk in depth about why we came to that conclusion and where it stems from.
That's a really interesting question of where is the line between values and politics? Could you talk a little bit more about how you think about that line and maybe even give an example of something that you determined to be a value versus a political move?
Yeah, I think it's difficult, right? And I mean, the first time I heard it, I didn't really agree with it. I was like, well, there's no line between values and politics. Like, politics stems from your values. And, you know, to some extent, that's true. And I think what, I mean, again, it was Jamie Dimon who really pushed us hard on this. And he used the following language that I thought started to get helpful, which is, you know, CEOs should not, or businesses should not allow themselves to become weaponized by people with a specific political agenda. And so I think there is a lot of gray area, and we pushed Jamie on this, right? Because he's come out against There were some incidents of anti-Asian, bigotry and hate crimes. At some point, he came out against that. There's some other examples, and we asked him about those, and he really tried to relate them back to the core values of, in his case, J.P. Morgan. And so, I think a counterexample of that might be, the Disney fight in Florida, where they, rather than expressing a value statement, we stand with and are supportive of our LGBTQ plus community, they decided they would take a specific stance on a specific bill in Florida. The bill eventually went away, but it ended up causing this sort of big fight. It was completely kind of there. They kind of walked right into it, right? I mean, they really, this was under Governor DeSantis, but they really sort of gave him an opening to create a wedge around an issue. And as politics has become increasingly focused on social issues, that I think worked not in Disney's favor. Now, Dan Schulman, for example, probably would have disagreed with that, right? Because he was, as an example, when he was at PayPal, very vocal against the North Carolina bill that came out that required people to use the bathroom of the gender that they were assigned at birth. And he was very vocal. They pulled out of North Carolina, or at least threatened to, until the bill eventually got repealed. And he was very vocal about that. And again, I think he would have said that he kind of went past values, but that it related to their values, that everyone needed to be treated equally at PayPal. So I give you those two stories because it's complicated. And if there was a clear line, I think we wouldn't be having this debate, right? And I think that there is a lot of room for gray area around what constitutes a value versus what constitutes politics, which is why you were right to push me on it. But I think that that framing is helpful, that not because you always make the right decision and realize which side of the line you're on, but I think that you can very quickly sort of chop off the ends and say, okay, neither of these two things make sense, and sort of debate more in the middle, which I think is kind of what we're arguing for.
Well, and I hope it's all right to say that you and I have both hosted political fundraisers and things in the past, and I always find it tricky to figure out which, if any, of my professional contacts I should invite to those things and which of my professional contacts I should have political conversations with and all those things. And it's tricky because it's all intertwined. So that's a long-winded way of asking, have you done anything to change your own behavior on this topic since writing this book?
I mean, one of the real gifts of writing the book was that I really sought out other perspectives. And it's not that I'm not generally open to other ways of thinking. It's just that, where I live and the people that I spend time with and the affiliations of my family, they've all kind of become a bit of a monoculture, right? And I didn't realize the extent to which it had. And I found a lot of value in seeking out alternative voices, and alternative viewpoints. And I continue to do that in the people that I read, the podcasts that I listen to. I really actually try to make more of an effort than I really ever have to get perspectives sort of on both sides, right? And for me, as someone who's sort of a bit centrist-ish, that includes voices from both sort of the political right and the political left, to at least listen to and hear what they're saying. Mamdani, as an example, I kind of referenced him in his rise as a socialist in New York. I disagree with a lot of what his policies are, but I'm trying to listen thoughtfully and carefully. And on the other side, I don't agree with a lot of sort of what the sort of political right is standing for at the moment, but I'm trying to be thoughtful and listening to voices, even if I don't agree with them, but at least to understand what they are saying. I don't know if you found that as well, Elizabeth, but it's a really interesting exercise. And again, I'm not talking about, I'm not spending hours listening to the, whatever, Kill All the Billionaires podcast stuff, or for that matter, the, Kill All the, people that aren't, Anglo-Saxon white males stuff as well. And there are people that are sort of saying both of those sorts of things. I'm only slightly exaggerating. So I'm not going down the crazy rabbit hole, but I'm trying to find thoughtful speakers on either side of the political spectrum, again, even if I don't agree with them.
Yeah, I'm trying to do that as well. And you asked me before we started this recording how my move to Montana was going. And I actually feel like that's one of the best benefits that I've seen from this move is that, like you were saying, I didn't really realize how much of an echo chamber I was living in until I moved out of Boulder, Colorado, and out of the venture capital world. I'm still in the venture capital world, but I'm not as entrenched as I was before. And just as one example, I'm living in Paradise Valley, Montana, which is about an hour from Bozeman. It's near the mouth of Yellowstone Park, and it's remote. And almost everyone I know drives a big gas guzzling pickup truck, which I had a lot of judgments about before. And now that I live down a bumpy dirt road that gets a lot of snow and wind and needs a high clearance car and does not have a garage with a nice place to plug in an electric car, I am thinking a little bit different about the way that I judge those people. And their income level is totally different than most of the people that I interacted with in Boulder, Colorado, too. So I think getting out of the echo chamber is important, and I am glad that this book gave you the opportunity to do that.
It's so healthy, Elizabeth. It's one of the things we actually talk about towards the end of the book as just a piece of advice, which is like one of the things you can do if you care about sort of the future of the economy and you want to sort of play a role in it, is to start to much better understand sort of the plight of people that aren't necessarily in the same demographic group as you. And the only way to really do that is to start meeting people from those groups. And I think familiarity breeds empathy. And I think we've seen this across a bunch of different issues in the US, but unfortunately, because the politics has become so polarized, and generally speaking, where you live defines, and that can be neighborhood to neighborhood, but defines who you spend time with from a political perspective. It can be really hard to foster those sort of those cross political divide perspectives, and it's, I think that's a real bummer. I mean, as I came up through business, there were a lot of people that were Republicans or Democrats, and talked about it in very productive and constructive ways. And I feel like those sorts of conversations have gone away. One, because people are, as you pointed out, there's some nervousness around, hey, what's appropriate and what's not appropriate. And then, two is because the types of people that are voting one way or the other tend to live, they tend to cluster. And so if you are of whatever political persuasion you're of, you probably live more closely in community with other people that feel the same way. And so it's hard to kind of reach out. But it, as you just described perfectly, having those experiences gives you a deeper understanding and some empathy for, for folks that maybe you didn't think totally about. And I think that's something we've lost in our politics. And frankly, I think that's one of the reasons why Democrats have struggled so much at the electoral box, at least nationally, over the last whatever 10, 12 years, is because they have been perceived to be, starting with especially Hillary Clinton, lacking that empathy.
Yeah, and I don't know, just as one additional example, I'm living in an area where the value of land has increased by about tenfold and the income has not increased. And people are going to vote based on property taxes, no matter what that candidate is saying beyond property taxes. Property taxes is the only thing that they're going to care about. And I think you did a good job of that in this book is understanding what people's real motives are and what are the most important things with the hierarchy of needs that they need to pay attention to. It really does, it helps just foster a much more productive conversation.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's a great example, right? Where if you weren't like right around those folks to have those conversations, you would have no understanding of like, hey, this is why this is a problem.
So one of the things that I miss about Boulder, Colorado, and being in closer contact with people like you, Seth, is a real commitment to philanthropy. and making a difference. And I'd love to hear a little bit more about what you think. Let's start with just the average everyday person who wants to do something small to support the productive evolution of capitalism. What would you recommend that they do?
Yeah, I think the first step depends a little bit on sort of where you are in your business and so if you run a company versus you're an employee at a company, but I think what we just talked about actually would probably be my first and most universal suggestion for people, which is that I think everyone would do well and would benefit from taking a step back and seeking out other perspectives. And again, if that's not easy and you don't have easy access to a person, there are lots and lots of podcasts and other things to pay attention to that have different perspectives, and I would encourage people to consider that. In terms of like how do we move capitalism forward in a productive direction, it's one of the reasons I'm so interested in the work that the Business Roundtable has done, because I think that they're trying to lay a roadmap for what that might look like. So certainly if you're a CEO talking about values, relating that to your business, we talk a lot about creating an ownership economy, and that should be sort of across business types. We do it well in the technology world, but it's actually not that common outside of technology. And so thinking about structures that enable your people that work with you to share in the prosperity of your business and your success is something you can do. If you are a worker at one of those businesses, doing some research around EOPs or ESOPs, which are the two sort of common ways to share ownership, makes a lot of sense as well. And also doing maybe grounds up work on what are the values of my company and what do we care about? Like I think that it is important to recognize that big companies and small companies all have a role to play here in defining this future, and that we definitely should not just simply wait for the biggest companies in the world to take these actions, right? It's not that the Business Roundtable companies need to sort of figure it all out and then the next group follow. It could actually be a little bit of the opposite, right? I mean, they have some thoughts on moving in this direction, but we should grab that across our society. And there's a bit of a blueprint for that in Capital Evolution. So if people pick it up, they can get some more details on this. And it's not a policy book per se, but there are some policy ideas in it. But there are a lot of things that people can do to try to push this forward. And I think recognize that where we are is not sustainable. It's funny. I just read the new Andrew Ross Sorkin book. I know it's a podcast about my book, but I'll recommend his book too, 1929. And I thought a lot about sort of the similarities between the late 20s and what we're experiencing now in terms of these economic divisions and economic concentration. And ultimately, they were incredibly destabilizing. Ironically, after the crash and the Great Depression, the New Deal, and then the Second World War, the U.S. economy, sort of post World War II up until sort of the early 70s, was in its golden age of capitalism. That's what it's called, and it was golden because the U.S. economy actually grew faster than it's been growing since then, right? And at the same time, prosperity was shared more evenly. And so it just doesn't work in the last 25 years, to have 12% increase in wages total over that entire period of time for the average middle class worker, but have a 900% increase for the average CEO. It's just we're getting too far out of alignment. And again, that's kind of what happened in the late 20s and 1920s, and it did not work out well. So we're not quite, but nearing 100 years on from that. And I'd hope we could learn from history at least a little bit.
And then how about something bigger? So maybe if it's somebody who's got a lot of connections, maybe in politics or in business, what kind of strings would you hope someone would pull or connections you hope that someone would make?
Yeah, I mean, I'm trying to stay positive about our politics, but it's so partisan. But there are, I think things that we can do, I mean, ultimately what we argue for is creating more capitalists. And I think one of the things that we do in our politics that's very pernicious is that we're constantly arguing about how to divide the pie and not spending enough time talking about how we grow a bigger pie. And while I'm not dismissing the questions of sort of how do we split things up and what does that translate to for whatever tax policy and things like that, to your point about property taxes going up a lot, but wages not, as an example. But I think we also need to look at how do we grow the pie itself. And so, for the politically correct connected, well, one, reach out to me and I've got a bunch of very specific ideas. But there are a bunch of things that we talk about that are potential incentives to building more of an ownership economy. And I think one of the reasons this is so important is if you look back 50, 70 years ago, the biggest companies in the world, if you look at their revenue, a much larger portion of their revenue was paid out to workers in the form of wages. Now, if you look at the biggest companies in the world, they're the tech companies, right? It's Meta, it's Alphabet, it's Nvidia, and a significantly lower portion of their revenues goes to workers, and a much higher portion of their revenues goes to the owners. If you only participate in the economy as a worker, you have very limited opportunities to generate any kind of wealth, right? Whereas if you participate as an owner in the capital class, you have all sorts of opportunities to build wealth. And so, one of the things that we talk about a lot in the book is how do we create more capitalists? How do we create more people who have a stake in the system? And I think if you look at why is voting happened in the way that it's happened, why did Mamdani win in New York? Well, too many people didn't feel like they had any stake in the market system. And so why not blow it up completely? Which is the same reason that a double-digit percentage number of Mamdani voters were Trump voters as well, right? And you'd think that would be anathema, but actually the underpinnings to their discontent are all the same, right? It's lack of economic opportunity, lack of economic mobility. And so helping create pathways for that, I think, is really important.
And then lastly, how about something that someone with some financial resources could do? If someone wants to put some money behind the evolution of capitalism, what would you suggest that they would do?
Yeah, I mean, I believe that financial capital and the concentration, frankly, of financial capital is a little bit disconcerting. We have an entire chapter about this. So I'd start with making kind of your own investment decisions, at least with a portion of your capital, and not necessarily concentrating it in sort of one of the big, BlackRock, Apollo, like the big consolidated financial firms, because they're becoming almost too powerful, right? And so I would look at that, and then I would invest along your values, right? I mean, I think that there is lots of reason to believe that investors can move markets, right? And money talks. And then lastly, I would shop along those values as well. And this is not an argument for small versus big or local versus not, although there's plenty of arguments for those as well. But it's more, spend your dollars in ways that, align with the things that you care about. But I think that there's also sort of a community role that people with resources can play. And we really argue for this in our last book, The New Builders, but this idea of investing in place, and it's kind of what my wife's been doing now for, the last 10 years, is really being, in her case, very hands-on, because she's literally, redeveloping these buildings and then finding the right tenants to put in them, oftentimes at discounted rents, so that she can kind of build place. That's an extreme example because she's really, spent a lot of time, effort, and money to do that. But there are other examples of opportunities for people to support local businesses in a way that sort of prop community up. And I think that's always a great place to start if you have some resources.
Thank you. Well, in closing, is there one last imperfectly honest thought that you'd like to share?
I mean, the perfectly honest thought is I'd love people to buy the book. I really, we don't write to sort of make money. We have to sell a lot of books to make money, and we're spending a decent amount on marketing it and trying to get the word out. But we're doing that because we really want people to be exposed to our ideas and to read our ideas. And so my request to people on this podcast who are listening would be go pick it up. Right? Pick up two. Buy one for yourself, buy one for a friend so you can have a conversation about it. And then reach out. My email's all over the internet. If you just Google Seth and Foundry, you'll find it. And let me know what you think. Let Elizabeth McBride, my co-author, know what you think. I'd really appreciate that.
Great. Well, people, buy the book
Capital
and
Evolution. Say it one more time.
Capital Evolution, Seth Levine and Elizabeth McBride. Seth, thank you so much for doing this today. I have to admit, I was kind of in a funk. This will probably come out after Thanksgiving, but it's the Friday before Thanksgiving, and most of the people I know are leaving to go home. And one of the nice things that I've experienced over the last couple of years is leaving home and having new experiences. But it's one of those times that I feel like I want to go home, and for reasons I don't really have time to explain, they're just logistical reasons I decided to not opt out of going home. So this is a long-winded way of saying thank you for talking to you. Felt like home, and it's nice to just sort of see a familiar face and to remember the intellectual inspiration and the commitment to philanthropy that I so appreciate about Boulder, Colorado, where I called home for most of my adult life. So you're the perfect personification of that,
Well,
Seth.
that makes me incredibly happy. We miss you a lot here in Boulder, Elizabeth. I'm glad we could reconnect like this. It was really fun.
It was. Thank you. All right. Well, have a great Thanksgiving. And to all of our listeners, thank you. And until next time.
Thanks, everyone.